ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening, welcome to PM. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, the government defends plans to overhaul the NDIS, despite criticism from disability advocates. Also, confusion in the Strait of Hormuz as Iran fires on cargo ships. And researchers study the health impacts of reducing the plastic packaging of our food.
You can reduce the amount of these hormone-disrupting chemicals in the body by changing your diet and your lifestyle. What is most difficult at this point is that many of these plastic exposures happen before your food even gets to the supermarket.
The White House is playing down the significance of Iran's seizure of two vessels in the Strait of Hormuz. Iranian state television has shown dramatic footage of armed commandos boarding the container vessels. Washington insists the move is not a violation of the current ceasefire, but the Trump administration is under increasing pressure over the stalemate. Barbara Miller reports.
Speedboats approach the Panama-flagged MSC Francesca and the Liberia-flagged Epaminondas in the Strait of Hormuz. The footage aired on Iranian state television shows Revolutionary Guard commandos with their faces covered board the container vessels brandishing weapons. Iran accuses the ships of breaking rules and tampering with navigation equipment. A third vessel was reportedly fired upon. It looks like a dramatic escalation in the key shipping lane, but the White House spokeswoman Carolyn Leavitt says it doesn't constitute a ceasefire violation.
No, because these were not U.S. ships. These were not Israeli ships. These were two international vessels. And for the American media, who is sort of blowing this out of proportion to discredit the president's facts that he has completely obliterated Iran's conventional navy, these two ships were taken by speedy gunboats. Iran has gone from having the most lethal navy in the Middle East to now acting like a bunch of pirates.
Iran, on the other hand, is accusing the U.S. of violations with its blockade of ships leaving and entering Iranian ports. In a social media post, Parliamentary Speaker Mohammed Bagar Ghalibaf said the action amounted to taking the global economy hostage. It doesn't seem like the two countries are moving closer to a second round of peace talks, even if Donald Trump really wants an out. William Roback is Executive Vice President of the Arab Gulf States Institute and a former U.S. ambassador to Bahrain.
He wants an off-ramp. He's working towards it. He's got negotiators going out. But I'm not sure how much he has empowered them to be flexible or what kind of sophistication they've put into their negotiating framework, what kind of bridging proposals. It's a little unclear.
Donald Trump has extended the ceasefire with Iran until negotiations conclude. The White House says there's no time limit on that extension. Carolyn Leavitt.
The president has not set a deadline himself. Ultimately, he will dictate the timetable.
But the optics aren't good. For one, it looks like Iran is currently dictating the timetable. It was Tehran, after all, who didn't commit to sending a team to a second round of negotiations in Islamabad, leaving Vice President J.D. Vance to cancel his trip. Then there's the issue of the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon. The two countries are set to hold a second round of talks later on Thursday, Washington time, about extending that agreement beyond its April the 26th deadline.
One journalist has been killed and another wounded in an Israeli attack on the town of Atziri in southern Lebanon.
Tensions have further escalated with the death of a Lebanese journalist, Amal Khalil, in what her employer says was an IDF strike while she was seeking shelter.
Lebanon's Prime Minister, Nawaf Salam, says the targeting of journalists and the alleged obstruction of rescue efforts constitutes a war crime.
The Israeli military said its strikes were on a vehicle and structure used by Hezbollah. The IDF says the incident is under review. From Iran's standpoint, any progress on the wider conflict will likely be dependent on a continued ceasefire in Lebanon. And then there's the matter of congressional approval for war. Attempts by Democrats to curb Donald Trump's action on Iran have so far failed in the House and Senate, with Republicans broadly appearing to accept the president's case that he's not acting illegally, but under the War Powers Statute. That statute, however, sets a 60-day deadline on the use of military force without congressional approval, and that's now less than a week away. Donald Trump could then technically grant himself one extension, but he may find patience running increasingly thin.
Barbara Miller reporting. The federal government is defending its decision to overhaul the National Disability Insurance Scheme. It says the changes are needed to ensure the future viability of the NDIS and to return the scheme to its original intent, that is, to support individuals with significant and permanent disabilities. But this hasn't quelled anxiety amongst NDIS participants, who fear they'll lose access to support they rely on. Tanya Dendrinos has more.
160,000 people who currently access the National Disability Insurance Scheme will no longer be eligible by 2030. The changes announced by Health Minister Mark Butler yesterday are designed to rein in the growing cost of the scheme. Today, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese recapped the four pillars of the government's plan.
Fighting fraud and stopping rorts, I would have thought pretty sensible. Slowing rapid cost increases, quite clearly. 22% increases was not sustainable. Clearer eligibility requirements and making sure, importantly, the fourth element linked to that, which is delivering quality services and support to participants.
The changes aim to bring the cost of the NDIS down to $55 billion in 2030 from the $70 billion currently forecast. The government has reiterated that it wants to return the NDIS to its original intent, which it says is to support people with permanent and significant disability. Dr. Martin Laverty was one of the original architects of the NDIS and is now the CEO of disability services provider Aruma. He explains why more guardrails weren't put in place when the scheme was originally designed.
Because it was rushed and we were too optimistic. If you recall the period when the NDIS was first legislated, the opposition leader, Tony Abbott, at that point very quickly did a deal with Prime Minister Gillard that secured support for the NDIS through the Parliament. What didn't happen was detailed examination of the definition of who's eligible and what the scheme should fund.
The Health Minister has announced that NDIS eligibility rules will be overhauled, with access to be based on a person's functional capacity and how it impacts their day-to-day living rather than a diagnosis from 2028. The government says that work will be done in partnership with the disability community, states and territories, and a technical advisory group. But Dr. Laverty says in the meantime, uncertainty for NDIS participants will remain. Emma Bennison is the CEO of Disability Advocacy Network Australia.
I don't think anyone who has been following the NDIS since its inception would disagree that change is required. However, I think the important thing is that that change doesn't leave anybody worse off.
The Health Minister has offered an assurance that those who no longer meet the eligibility criteria won't be moved off the NDIS until there are other support programs run by the states and territories in place. That includes the Thriving Kids program, which will cater for kids aged 8 and under who have low to moderate developmental delays or autism. It's due to roll out from October, but Queensland is yet to sign up.
We're hearing narratives around we just need to rebuild the systems that were there prior to the NDIS. Well, I can well remember what it was like pre-NDIS, and I can tell you that many of those systems either existed but were failing or didn't exist at all, particularly for people who live in regional and remote communities. So it's very concerning.
Those concerns have been echoed across state and territory governments too. Speaking in state parliament, Queensland's Minister for Families, Seniors and Disability Services, Amanda Cam, was scathing, accusing the federal government of walking away from its responsibility for people living with a disability.
The same government who established the National Disability Scheme will introduce legislation without consultation with states and territories, nor peak sectors, that will ultimately change the course and direction of lives for almost 160,000 Australians living with a disability. And what does that mean for parents of children with autism in Queensland? It means if you have one-on-one occupational therapy or speech therapy, then say goodbye to it.
New South Wales Premier Chris Minns says his government simply can't afford to offer those coming off the NDIS the same level of support.
I understand the reasons for it, but we've got to be honest with the public and say it won't be like-for-like services provided by the state because we don't have the resources to do it. We don't have the money to do it. I understand that it needs to be as best as possible an affordable program, but we've also got to be honest with people. If they're not going to be provided with NDIS support, we can't provide equivalent care in the state system.
New South Wales Premier Chris Minns ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. In the AFL, Carlton's coach has labelled the intense scrutiny surrounding one of his side's players, who's currently suffering a mental health episode, as bullying. Carlton player Elijah Hollands acted erratically during last week's game and was later hospitalised. The incident has sparked an intense conversation about elite sport and mental health, as Oliver Gordon reports.
In footage that's been replayed incessantly on broadcast channels and social media, 23-year-old Carlton player Elijah Hollands acts erratically on field, even struggling to kick a football in the warm-up. Those looking on in the stands didn't know it at the time, but the 23-year-old was having an acute mental health episode and would soon be hospitalised. Commentators in the famously ruthless AFL media landscape have been quick to point the finger at Carlton for failing to bring the player off the field earlier.
We've unfortunately, rather than make this a private challenge, we've made this a public event.
Today, the club's coach, Michael Voss, hit back.
So the commentary, the conversation, the ball-by-ball play, we've unfortunately made it at that. And in some ways, like, I'll be really honest, it's felt like a bordering on bullying.
The AFL is working with Carlton to understand what went wrong last Thursday night and how it can avoid it happening again. And WorkSafe has confirmed it's conducting preliminary inquiries into the matter. Michael Voss has called for more understanding and for those who support his playing group to be applauded.
It's a complex situation that has history and background. There's no one the same, but in behind it is a wave of support from people that are on the ground, that live in the shadows, that work with people daily on this sort of stuff, and I think we should applaud them.
Unlike suspected concussion incidents during play, where protocols are triggered and players are removed from games, there are no official guardrails in place for managing mental health incidents on the field. This episode has prompted other clubs to review their practices and kick-started a conversation about elite sport and mental health that some experts say is long overdue.
For some athletes during their peak competitive years, they will experience significant mental health challenges.
Dr. Simon Rice is a psychologist and chief impact officer at the Movember Institute of Men's Health and isn't commenting on Elijah Holland's individual case, but sharing his insights on mental health and elite sport.
And for some athletes, that those challenges with mental health or mental ill health will reach a crisis point. Being able to talk about it, being able to reach out for support, for that to be understood within the community is really important.
Elijah Holland's brother and father have posted messages of love and support for him as he recovers. As discussion of his case continues, it's been announced former number one draft pick Jamara Ugle-Hagan will return to AFL football this weekend for his first game in almost 600 days after taking time off to improve his mental health. Dr. Simon Rice says it's critical the issue continues to be studied and spoken about with care, particularly by the media.
We'll know we've made real progress when we don't see major media headlines around people experiencing difficulties in their daily workplace environment. For some people, that's just going to happen, and we need to make sure that we're providing the right kind of support rather than scrutiny or innuendo or problematic media stories.
That's Dr. Simon Rice from the Movember Institute of Men's Health. Oliver Gordon, the reporter. This is PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. As the fuel crisis deepens, those in remote communities across Australia fear they'll be unable to access diesel fuel to run their local power stations. Now, two communities in the Northern Territory are tackling the problem head-on by building their own solar farms and microgrids. They're the first two communities in the country to be awarded federal government funding for projects completely owned and operated by local Indigenous people. Jane Barden reports.
Garawa ceremony man Gedrian Hussein is among residents of the NT remote Boralula community today celebrating that they've secured $8 million in federal government funding to build their own solar farm and a microgrid to get the electricity to their homes.
It's mean a lot because, you know, the diesel cost is too high and the power bill is too high.
He says the community of 750 on the Gulf of Carpentaria are struggling to afford power cards to keep their electricity on because the global fuel crisis has pushed diesel and food prices sky high, so they can't wait for the cheaper solar power being promised.
Everyone excited about it. The renewable energy will make it a lot easier for a lot of our people in the community.
The project is being developed by an Indigenous corporation called Original Power. One of the developers, Scott McDinney, says because the profits will go back into his community, it will reduce all Boralula residents' power bills by 50%.
So everyone have more money to go towards food.
Boralula is one of the hundreds of remote communities worried that global fuel shortages will stop them getting diesel for their local power stations. Scott McDinney says the solar project will provide 80% of Boralula's power after it's built early next year. The community will still rely on the NT government's local power station for the remaining 20%, but the station's diesel needs will be 1.2 million litres less each year.
We're like 380 kilometres east from the Stuart Highway, and it costs the government a whole lot of money to get the diesel out there, so we're trying to reduce the cost of diesel from going out there.
Original Power says it's almost raised the rest of the $19 million needed for the project. Its co-director Maddie Sturgis says the biggest hurdle has been getting permission to connect to the NT's grid.
Anyone who is trying to put up a renewable energy project in this country knows how hard it is. We are seeing development delays as a result of this, challenging the utilities to engage the transition.
The other project in Santa Teresa has got $3 million in federal funding. The funding is from the federal government's $125 million Regional Microgrids Fund. It's already given money to South and Western Australian projects. But Nick Duart from the federal government's Renewable Energy Agency, ARENA, says the two NT projects are special because they're the first totally Indigenous-owned.
This is about getting First Nations communities off dirty diesel and getting reliable energy. But extra important is the fact that these two projects are actually owned, developed and delivered by the communities themselves.
Indigenous Australians Minister Mulindiri McCarthy says she's hopeful other communities will be able to replicate the projects to improve their energy affordability and security.
We see what's happening around the world at the moment in terms of energy. And what we're seeing here today is two communities who are really stepping up. This is what we want to see happen in closing the gap, working in partnership with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people on the solutions that they see works for them.
That's Federal Indigenous Australians Minister Mulindiri McCarthy. Jane Barden reporting. You probably wash your fruit and veggies before starting dinner to remove any dirt or other nasties. But long before they've reached your home, tiny pieces of plastic may have leached into your food. The idea of plastics staying in our bodies is scary stuff. But long-term research from the University of Western Australia has shown that when people reduce their exposure to plastic, levels detected in the body quickly fall. Angus Randall reports.
Your food labels have essential information on the amount of fat, sugar and salt you're about to consume. But what about plastic?
We found they were coming predominantly from food, particularly ultra-processed foods and packaged foods, as well as the tins and tin linings.
Professor Michaela Lucas from the University of Western Australia's Medical School has been researching the amount of plastic chemicals entering the body through the food we eat.
Phthalates, for example, are carrying fragrances in a lot of your products, like washing powders and so on. They're also there to make soft glad wrap and soft plastics. And the hard plastics, bisphenols are added, such as BPAs or hard plastic bottles.
Existing research shows how plastic chemicals can leach into the body through food, food containers, and products like deodorant and shampoo. But this study sought to learn what happened when the plastic stopped coming in.
And by doing that for a week, we were able to show that you can reduce these plastic-associated chemicals that you're normally exposed to, even within a week.
It found a week of near total plastic avoidance can reduce the levels of plastic chemicals in the body by up to 50%. It wasn't as simple as keeping away from cling wrap and single-use packaging. Researchers had to go all the way back to the source. Dietitian Dr. Amelia Harray is a clinical lead in the ongoing project and liaised with more than 150 farmers and food producers to remove plastic from their production line.
These food producers surprised us with how keen they were to be involved, but also really openly disclose all the potential plastics that their foods touch.
You might struggle to find someone who says that ingesting plastic is good for you. But the exact impact of plastic on the body has been hard to prove until recently.
Some of these plastic chemicals that have been researched have been linked to health conditions like reproductive issues or cardiovascular issues to do with your heart or respiratory issues. What our research has really shown that's never been shown before is that you can reduce the amount of these hormone-disrupting chemicals in the body by changing your diet and your lifestyle.
The University of WA team will next investigate the potential impact of plastics on fertility. Lucy Lines is a fertility educator and IVF scientist not involved in the WA study. She believes these findings will give hope to those worried about the level of plastics already in their body.
People do hear, oh, you've got, there's microplastics found in placental tissue, or microplastics found in seminal plasma, or microplastics even found in the cord blood of newborn babies. And we all kind of freak out and go, oh my God, it's everywhere, I can't avoid it. But actually, this study is showing us that we can, by reducing our exposures, we can actually reduce the toxic load of the whole body.
What would your advice be to someone who is listening to this, very scared and wants to take some steps?
My number one piece of advice is don't not do one thing just because you can't do all the things. So, you know, when you look at it all, you go, oh my God, I can never do that. I can't do it. It's too hard. I'm not doing anything. That's the worst thing you can do. Just do one thing. Just do one thing. Swap your water bottle for a stainless steel water bottle, or swap your plastic container that you put your soup in that you just made for a glass one. Just do one thing and then take it from there.
Lucy Lines is a fertility educator and IVF scientist. Angus Randall, our reporter. Finally tonight, he was a fixture on the radio, a companion on the airwaves, and our beloved colleague. ABC broadcaster, musician and writer James Valentine has died using voluntary assisted dying after being diagnosed with esophageal cancer 2 years ago. He was 64. For three decades on the air, James Valentine used his characteristic humour and warmth to keep us company, entertain us, and remind us of our shared humanity. Rachel Hayter prepared this tribute.
It ain't no use to sit and whine and why, babe.
It is big. It is sort of to have done it for so long and to have been able to be in something I love for so long is just really quite extraordinary.
We're going to miss him so much. He's just remarkable.
Unlike some radio presenters, he wasn't nasty. He wasn't sort of sniping and putting people down. He always left me feeling uplifted after I'd listened to him on the radio.
And you sat in the car, you know, listening to James, and it made you feel that you were in a city of clever, beautiful people. I think what it was about was honouring humanity, honouring the foibles of human beings, whether it was how to pack a dishwasher or how to put the clothes on a line, to actually treat those things with respect.
Gee, that's my lunch tomorrow. That is my lunch tomorrow. Vegemite and a salt and vinegar chip sprinkled through the sandwich.
What you live with is a ringtail possum, or rather a husband and a ringtail possum.
Yes, and things are getting worse.
Everyone knows that he was such a kind man and so generous and compassionate, but he was just such a great dad as well. And he was so, that kindness and compassion came through so much for us as well.
Thank you to you for listening, and thank you for letting me do it. Goodbye.
farewell to the late, great James Valentine. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. The podcast of the full PM program is available on ABC Listen, and that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump is all in on it, but could we, drill baby drill, our way out of any future oil shocks? We have been mostly self-sufficient in fuel production before, so why not again? Today, Alison Reeve, energy expert from the Grattan Institute, on whether we really could reopen oil refineries across the country. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.